This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Tēnā koutou. Ko te mea tuatahi, te kōrero te matamaku ki tō tātou kāinga. Are my first words I offer to our Creator. Ko te mea tuarua. Ngā aitua o te marae maha, o te mana o te whenua. Haere, haere, haere. I now greet those ancestors that have walked this land, and I farewell them. And also like to mihi you, ngā mihi atu ki a koutou, and ngā mana ngā reo. E te tangata whenua, Ngānawa, a tēnā koutou. And to the Ngānawa people, I also greet, that provide us the opportunity to meet here together today. Can you hear me? Okay. I'll just pull the microphone up. Is that a bit better? Okay, I'll do my usual slouch, that might help. Just to start off with, I'd just like to resonate with the previous speakers, with Paul Turnbull. What he offered this morning was one sentence in particular I hung on to, but I'm hanging off now. And that is when he stated that at not Banks but Tupaia, he sees him as perhaps the founder of Pacific ethnography. And that's something that how can I best say this? It's perhaps demonstrating the growth and the growing maturity of us as academics in the South Pacific, of realizing that there's more than one narrative to any picture we look at. And until recently, we entertained the popular narrative, the one of the colonizer, you could say. And that other narrative, but a generation ago, represented a story that we weren't really that keen to hear. We prefer, perhaps, to look at those stories of the conquerors rather than the conquered. But it depends on which side of the beach you're looking at, who's conquering who. And my paper today is, in a way, just to raise questions, not to contest so much, but to invite all of us as academics and otherwise to see where the twin streams of our histories, both in Australia and New Zealand, might actually integrate and unite and create a platform for something a bit bigger, something that represents our identity going into the future, something our children, our grandchildren, can take for granted and then look at what they need to discuss concerning their identity in the future. And at this very point in time, we find ourselves looking at our identity with Cook as our focus in this symposium. Adrian provided us an opportunity to delight in her detective skills. That she's an academic, we're lucky. I'm sure any police force in this country would be very happy to have her detective skills. And they're meticulous. It's because of her that people like Paul, myself, Greg, that we're able to speak today. She has been able to bring back together those three voyages of Cook to better understand the artificial curiosities of those three voyages and find them again. And with distance, we can now have a greater understanding of what perhaps they represented. And of course, with Greg assisting us in redirecting our gaze and providing me, as Margot pointed out, the opportunity to invite you to look at my gaze back across the beach with the trees behind me. Now, I normally don't read papers because I normally don't write them, but the organisers said this might lead to publication, so that panicked me into writing something. And then when I learnt that my esteemed mentors, Greg Denning, Adrian Kepler, Lissant, and then also Roger Neish, who I work with, were going to be present today, I lost all confidence in believing I could talk on the hoof. So I've provided myself with an opportunity of reading. So the first thing is, as raised in the discussion last night by Ian, asked me what I thought of Cook, and I said, well, who's he? From a Maori perspective, Cook, oh, that's that famous Pākehā navigator who named himself on mountains and beaches and other places within New Zealand and out into the Pacific. Joseph Banks, Banks Peninsula, or wasn't he this young man, this young adventurer that the English thought very much of? I generally, Maori people know very little about Cook and Banks, other than, in a lot of ways, like the Aboriginal people, part of that beginning of colonisation, part of the beginning of the end, perhaps. But for our early ancestors that engaged with Cook, they would have, or the Endeavour, they probably also saw it as an opportunity. Saw it as an opportunity to access new resources of a new people that arrived over the horizon. And what would have motivated them would have been survival. Perceived opportunity, but also perhaps a perceived threat. To not engage could have been more dangerous than to engage. To get it wrong could also lead to the extinction of your kin group. There was a lot at stake, and that responsibility fell on the leader of that clan, of that kin group. Just to set the context, most tribes in New Zealand, if not all, still think like islands, like the islands they came from. They still maintain boundaries like they're beaches with oceans between. Those boundaries are negotiated through marriages, through wars. And from time to time, tribes are absorbed into larger tribes, or new tribes break out of larger tribes back into small ones. But still, the idea of being an island continues to manifest itself in Maori people today. A lot of our customs are still based around welcoming visitors onto our beach, onto our marae. We pull their canoe up onto our marae. We welcome them as visitors that have come afar across the water, even though we might be landlocked. So today I contest, where would New Zealand be if not for Tupaia? What kind of New Zealand would we have if Cook had not returned to England with his maps and the knowledge he'd gained on his travels? Did Tupaia in some way have an influence? And I think Greg has already introduced that idea. What role did Tupaia play? And when we look through the history books currently written, Tupaia remains low-key, perhaps even invisible in many ways, but not amongst those who are descended from the ancestors that interacted with him. So if we fast forward 100 years from 1769, when Tupaia and Captain Cook and Joseph Banks first landed on a beach in Gisborne, New Zealand, 100 years after that, colonisation was in full flight in New Zealand, and the emergence of colonial museums, a place where the other, from a Maori perspective I'm talking about, could publicly justify their rights of authority over a colonial landscape. A representation, according to the colonisers, according to the collectors, not the colonised nor the collected. Things have changed more recently, and but that's not the subject of my paper today, as much as I'd like to talk about that. The Auckland Museum, the place where I work today, has been open to the public since 1852. It's one of the oldest institutions in the world that has been open to the public. It wasn't a place just for scholars to visit by appointment. This was somewhere where people of Auckland could walk off the streets straight in to look at cabinets of curiosities. Around 1900, it received from Kew Gardens 510 pressed plant specimens collected by Banks and Salander during the Endeavour visit to New Zealand in 1769-1770. These were not the only things collected by Captain Cook and his gentleman amateur of science, as Beaglehole would state. The latter, Joseph Banks, may have been just 25 years old, but his well-heeled gentry connections brought him cabin space to accommodate his very own scientific entourage of seven plus two dogs. Led by Linus's protege, Dr. Sullender, Banks' team were responsible for returning to England many thousands of botanical and zoological specimens and a few hundred or so artificial curiosities. With each new landing, the ever-adventurous Banks was not unafraid to engage local hospitality while his team carefully collected, documented, pressed, and sketched, painted in his trail. On returning home in 1771, Dr. Sullender oversaw the careful repository of the vegetable, animal, and mineral specimens in the British Museum of Natural History. At that time, the noble savage curiosities were comparatively worthless, things that we've spoken about today and yesterday, both scientifically and monetarily. Nevertheless, they eventually found their way into cabinets of curiosities across Europe. Although little or nothing was done to catalogue or differentiate these from later day collected, from later items collected by Cook and other European explorers until some 100 years into the future. Today we are left with mostly circumstantial evidence by which the original Endeavour voyage's artificial curiosities can be identified. Surviving written evidence suggests Cook and Banks utilised Maori curios to their own ends, willingly gifting them to King, Admiralty, gentrified friends, and learned colleagues. Which way is this going? There you go. Thanks to the work of Kepler, Gathercole, Coutts, we have a better idea of where artifacts associated with Cook's three voyages are resting, some of which are currently on display here today. The aim of this paper, however, is to question the pathway by which two or three highly prized taonga, attributed to Banks and Cook, came to leave their kin communities in the first place. There has been some speculation concerning acquisition of the Tuburgian popo, the carved slab of Totara, but I leave that for others to draw focus. My interest lies with the personal, with wearable markers of status, and even today, such markers of status are withheld, sometimes for generations, until an appropriate receiver and occasion warrants release. Furthermore, the receiver would be made aware of the symbolic import of accepting such things, obligations of reciprocity, the relation inherent, and not least, the custodial duties one must thereafter carry when caring for such an ancestral treasure, or what we as Māori would say, he taonga. The slide here states, ko ngā kuri puri puri o Tāmaki e kore e ngaro e te pō. Those of Tāmaki who would lead in peace or in war never rest. Kuri puri puri is reference to those chiefs and only those chiefs or ariki that wore the spotted dogskin cloak. It was a statement of their high mana. Recently, the Auckland Museum Trust Board, also known as Tāmaki Paengahera, named by the local indigenous peoples of Auckland, invited me to assist finding an appropriate quotation to be engraved on the entrance of our new $65 million grand atrium. The quotation needed to not only capture the museum's Anzac spirit — we became a war memorial in 1929 when we moved into a new building, but we still remain a museum of all things. So the quotation needed to not only capture the museum's Anzac spirit, but also signify the promise of peace for which many sacrificed their lives. Musings of Greek philosophers were compared to more modern day quotations from Te Whiti, Gandhi, JFK, and Martin Luther King. But none seemed to hit the mark until we turned to Auckland's local tribe, Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei. Why turn to them? The Trust Board recognised them as having successfully held authority over the Auckland Isthmus for 250 plus years, so that in itself at least qualified them to present a perspective, if they had one, of course. Their surprise response, as you can read at the moment, captured everyone's imagination. It alluded to not just ancient rites of birth, but also the inherent responsibilities of leadership. A kin's survival rested on the vigilance of leaders, pure kure kure, not least the paramount chief, or ariki. It was he who wore, it was what he wore that set him apart from the rest through the generations, the dog, spotted dogskin cloak. While in discussion with Ngāti Whātua about the possible use of this ancient proverb, I was also contemplating this paper, imagining the Māori world view of 1769 when Tupaia sailed over the horizon in a strange vessel. It was really bending my mind. How did my ancestors react to seeing one of their own kin from their ancient homeland of Tawhiti commanding a crew of strange-looking men armed with equally strange magical-like weapons? From that first encounter, it appears Tupaia left Māori in little doubt that he was Ariki, high-born. He demonstrated genealogical knowledge of the high-born, wielded great authority over strange men and weapons, and spoke the ancient dialect of the tapu of the restricted priestly school elite of Tapu Tapu Ātea. Word quickly spread throughout our land of the arrival of their ancestral matua, their ancestral father, from the most revered of marae in the entire eastern Pacific. Tapu Tapu Ātea, the navigational homeland marae of famous waka, famous canoes, like Te Aroa, Tainui, Matatua, Kurahopo. All Māori he encountered during the endeavour circumnavigation of New Zealand were in awe, and he was treated with the highest respect. Tupaia never visited Tāmaki, the Auckland Isthmus, but if he had, I have no doubt Ngāti Whātua would have prestated him a kuri purepure, the spotted dogskin cloak, in recognition of his ariki status, cementing a relational intention of reciprocity, what Māori call utu, for future generations to activate as required. Ngāti Whātua are not unique in this way of thinking. In fact, the presence of dog skin or dog hair on any cloak, weapon or in carving, denoting high genealogical status is familiar to most, if not all, tribes of New Zealand. Up to the times only recently passed, the dog was indulged by chiefly families like a favoured child, fulfilling roles of companionship, warmth, hunting, and guardianship. I mean, myself as a child, I grew up in a village where the dogs were the only living things that were indulged during ceremonies that could cut through this, through the tapu, the restricted space between visitor and the hosts. And our dogs always knew that was the time they could go through there without getting a good kick. They'd wander right through the middle and they'd go straight through. You'd have all these chiefs on one side being received by our chiefs on the other. And these pack of dogs just wander through, they'd look each way, straight down to the kitchen, and they knew they'd get a good kai down there, good feed. I grew up with that. And then 1991, the dog laws of our town, unfortunately, picked up on our gang of dogs when they were out visiting a local lady that was off village campus. And all those dogs were put down before we knew what had happened. Those dogs that we saw as being direct descendants of the dogs that came on our original canoe, okay, they intermarried a little, but they still had that knowledge. They still trained. The young were taught by the old, the customs, when you could walk, where you could, when you could beg, when you should, and every night they'd go home to their own families, whānau units, and sleep on the back doorstep. That was the dogs that I grew up with, but we don't have any more. Fortunately, there's still some villages in the back blocks at home. The dogs are still like that. But the dogs, very special position. And this is a picture of our meeting house, in which you can see this dog here. His name is Pōtaka Tawhiti. And Pōtaka Tawhiti, very famous to us. In fact, there were three of them. This one in particular was the very first one that lived at Rangiātia, where Tapu Tapu Ātea is. And the whole story of why we migrated from there is related to this story.
On occasion, chiefly dogs, wonderfully indulged, were sometimes ritually killed. either to manufacture a garment marking a special event, like the death of a leader, for example, Te Kahu Mamae or Parirotutu, or to provide chiefly nourishment to an ariki who was visiting, reflecting status of guest and generosity of host. You could offer, in a way, it's like offering your own child, but not. So it's sort of, the dog was of a status that when an ariki arrived, you could feed them nothing less than yourself. And so providing them with the feast of your own personal dog was showing your understanding of their status, thus reflecting status of guest and generosity of host. There's even a tribe in the far north that honours both dog and ancestor, and they name themselves the people of Kuri, Ngati Kuri, the people of the dog. However, inappropriate killing of such dogs triggered major wars, and the case of Te Arawa led to their migration from Tawhiti. Tawhiti is our way of saying ancient homeland, or Tahiti. And that was some 24 generations ago. This image depicts the Arawa dog Potaka Tawhiti, who was eaten by a rival tribe, whereas a number of descendants of Atua Matua and Potaka Tawhiti, Atua Matua standing on the head of this dog, consequently migrated from Tapu Tapuatia to Aotearoa, New Zealand. Their wider relations remained in Rangiatia, or what we also say Raiatia. Tapu Tapuatia, for me, became very personalised when my uncle, now passed on, visited that place and was able to stand on that marae and return home to New Zealand and talk to us about meeting the local people of Raiatia. And they were still able to speak the same language that was a priestly language that had been maintained through ritual. Also, our people, when they left 24 generations ago, they brought with them the relics, the stones of that marae, Tapu Tapuatia, and they placed it into the new landscapes where we established ourselves, and we still maintain those stories as well, and we know where those relics are buried. It gave us, you could say, the rights of access into a new landscape, bringing the marae from which we originated. One can only speculate how overwhelming it would have been 16 generations later for a Maori leader to genealogically connect to an ariki like Tupaia through the common ancestry of Atua Matua. Such a significant occasion might have elicited a feasting of dog in his honour and prestations of significant taonga that were both highly personal, like heitiki, you wear around your neck, greenstone, but also symbolised rank and common ancestry, cloaks adorned with dog hair. In a genealogical scenario of this imagining, no prestation to Tupaia could have been greater than the presentation of the Kuri Purepuri. The journals of the endeavour talk about crew members' constant failure to secure, through bartering, prized adornments representing leadership, like dogskin cloaks and items made from greenstone. But we now have evidence that at least two dogskin cloaks, Kuri Purepuri and a Kaitaka Kuri, and one heitiki came into Banks and Cook's possession. How did this occur, and why are the journals mute of such yearned success? What role did Tupaia play in this? Perhaps it was Tupaia who was originally prestated the chiefly garments associated with Cook's and Banks, and not least the heitiki that was eventually passed into King George III's possession. Was it during such occasions that in return Tupaia presented our people with his name? One can only speculate 200 odd years after the fact. From a Maori perspective, it is inconceivable that tribes' most valued taonga like kahukuri, dogskin garments, and ponamu, greenstone, reflecting both presenter and receiver status, were not offered to Tupaia. And for him to have refused would have been equally inconceivable. Not unimaginable, however, would have been Tupaia's likely response if aware of either Cook's or Banks' obvious envy by perhaps of him receiving such things, and perhaps in a very Polynesian way, he handed them to his English equals with a statement like, "Here, now you look after it for me." Like footprints in the sand, what real evidence exists today that prestations to Tupaia ever took place? It was while contemplating such a thought I received Jeremy Coote's publication, Curiosities from the Endeavour, a forgotten collection. I was not unfamiliar with Jeremy's research, having shared his excitement while Merita, my wife, and I were visiting Pitt Rivers Museum in 2003. It was the colour reproduction of the original Benjamin West portrait of Banks, however, that engaged me in a new way. Deliberate or just coincidence, the wearer holds the viewer with a direct gaze and is portrayed pointing to the tufts of dog hair bordering the tarnuckle on an extremely fine kaitaka, a garment of great status, reserved for chiefly wearing, now doubly elevated by its dog hair adornment, to which I have no doubt the then still young Joseph Banks was fully aware. Its unquestionable status reminds me of the collection of beautiful cloaks I viewed in the 1990s at the British Museum, that attentively provenance to the first voyage. Although official writings render Tupaia as near invisible, the existence of these most prized taonga suggests another narrative exists, one that has all but been washed away in the surf on which the first encounters of two people took place. Eight generations later, we are left asking questions. So how did these exquisite taonga come to be in the possession of a young gentleman amateur of science who, by all accounts, was not averse to seeking adventure in between his botanizing? Closer inspection of Banks Kuri Purepu reveals, like the kaitaka, that it too is finely woven. Uniquely designed to prevent penetration of an enemy dagger or spear by employing a tarnacle-like compacted single-pair twining throughout, the attention to detail in the presentation of borders, knotting, and integration of tufts of dog hair is uniquely superior. So how did Banks come into possession of two of the finest Māori cloaks surviving today? Did he win the affections of an ariki's daughter? Did he save the life of a chief's son? His journal is deafeningly quiet. To receive such taonga of status these cloaks represent implies that the presenter or presenters held Banks in the same high regard they would have credited Tupaia. Does this add up? But the sentiments by which Māori held Tupaia were not shared by Banks. In his writings, Banks' writing, it appears he was not overly impressed with him, even suggesting Tupaia was so proud and obstinate that he often made his situation on board both disagreeable to himself and those about him. Having lived in close quarters for some months, it is not unexpected that Banks would find Tupaia's culturally idiosyncratic ways a little foreign. Yet Banks and Cook remained uncomfortably dependent on Tupaia to negotiate the initial encounters of each landing. They were dependent on him for navigation to new isles, diplomatic and translation services, and negotiation of safe landing and provisions. This would quite likely have grated Banks' original reason for taking him on board in the first instance. As Greg has already mentioned, I do not know why I may not keep him as a curiosity, as well as some of my neighbours do lions and tigers, and perhaps contributed to his irritation. For whatever reason, Tupaia's not insignificant contributions to the 1768-1771 voyage has remained all but invisible. According to Salmon, she thinks that this is actually Banks himself receiving this crayfish or coda. It appears that the recent discovery that the naive native watercolours tentatively attributed to Banks were in fact the work of Tupaia. This has awakened scholars to the possibility that he was more than just a convenient translator who died en route while hitching a ride to England. With this in mind, I would like to suggest that Tupaia may well have played a much more pivotal role in the voyage. It appears that this was not lost on the local Māori. By November 1769, word had spread far and wide of Tupaia and his ship. For example, on arriving at Waio, Coromandel, the local tribes called for Tupaia by name. When Cook returned on his second voyage, Māori greeted him again by shouting for Tupaia, and then they grieved when they were told he was dead. As Salmon states, it seems that Māori thought the Endeavour was Tupaia's ship, and they mourned him and remembered him for generations. Apart from a scattering of other verifiable items, the Christchurch collection provides us a unique window of opportunity to view original artificial curiosities acquired by either Banks or Cook from New Zealand on the Endeavour voyage. From a Māori perspective, the taonga or chiefly symbolic representations of trust within this collection appear to testify to Pai's chiefly influence on the voyage at a critical juncture. In his own way, he ensured the Endeavour and those encountered while circumnavigating New Zealand inflicted the minimum harm on each other. We can only speculate whether Cook would have survived his many encounters with Māori without Tupaia there to mitigate the force of numbers that could easily have overwhelmed the Endeavour on any number of occasions. Later European voyages were not so fortunate. For example, Dufresne and even Cook himself struggled to overcome the communication barriers on future visits to New Zealand. And what came of Tupaia's belongings, or taonga, after his death? Surely a high priest of his status may well have had at least his own personal adornments. Given the relative lack of value such items represent to English society and science in the 18th century of enlightenment, I suggest the same fate befell his taonga as did his watercolours. The many deaths later in the voyage, Batavia and en route to South Africa, leaving only Banks and Solander standing, undoubtedly gave rise to confusion, not least concern to keep the scientifically important specimens in some order, and could have contributed to Banks' assimilation of any Tupaia-associated artificial curiosities on his returning home after 3 long years at sea. For Māori, Tupaia may have trodden lightly on our beaches, but his footprints continue to pattern our memories through oral history. 8 generations later, we still name our children after him, and the places he visited remain living narratives amongst those who hosted him and his peculiar entourage over 200 years ago. I suggest the same footsteps embodied in the woven or carved Māori curiosities of Cook's first voyage are also echoing through the marbled hallways of some of Europe's finest institutions of memory. Notwithstanding the Christchurch collection, evidence of Tupaia's presence remains invisible while public attention is time and again academically focused towards the deeds and collections of Cook. I tentatively suggest Tupaia's direct contributions, Pacific mapping, artwork and taonga, and indirect contributions to the Royal Society, not least, the safe arrival home of Cook, Banks and Solander and their precious cargo of scientific evidence, appears, in my mind at least, to deserve its very own walk in academic and museological history. Kia ora koutou, ka piti hono tātou hono, te hunga mate ki te hunga mate, to the dead let them join and depart, ka piti hono, tātou te hangaroa, kia tātou, to us the living, may we join together. Tēnā koutou, kia ora.
Questions and constructive comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul, very much. I've been inspired by the spotted dogskin cloak, and I was wondering, I know a little bit about what's happening with some artists now with dogskin cloaks. Do you feel that the cloak still has the same, say, perhaps power now that it did at Cook's time?
Probably more so because of the rarity. It's not something that's made anymore. And definitely, since most of us have lost our dogs, but the museums carry them, and for communities to engage with those precious garments in a way that brings them alive again is something we're exploring right now. There's an exhibition that's coming to Sydney on the 15th of September, and one of the key taonga in that is a dogskin cloak, and that's the kahu mamai o pare rautatu, or the cloak of pain. It's actually made up of about 8 or 9 dogs that were ritually slaughtered after their chiefs had been killed in a battle, and the one of the wives of the chiefs made this cloak and then travelled a great distance with the cloak and then wrapped herself in it and sat on the marae of another great warlord chief, or Ariki, Riri Maniapoto's great-grandfather, for 3 days on the marae, refusing food and water until he lifted that cloak off her and put it on his own shoulders, and in so doing, took on the pain and assisted in the utu, in the reciprocity required to rebalance the atrocity that happened. The rebalance wasn't going and killing people, it was actually facilitating the return of the heads of those who'd been killed so that a proper death ritual could occur. So they continue to, in our minds, be very important to us as a people.
Well, fantastic ideas here that you've put forth. And I'm wondering if these pieces had been given to Tupaia, would he have had something of equal importance to give back to the Maoris, and what might those be? And if such things were given to the Maoris, what happened to them?
In the first instance, and that's a good question, I think the thing that he gave the people, and it's intangible, it's not tangible, was his name. His name we treasure today, and we still name our children with that name. That, I feel, is probably what he gave us. Again, speculation perhaps, but that name, for example, one of the great chiefs of the Bay of Plenty area, his name was Tupaia. He was born, seems, maybe 1 or 2 years before the arrival of Cook. The name he carried all his life was associated with his paramount leadership, and he was asked twice to be the Maori king by the Waikato people, and he refused twice. A demonstration, I think, of the status that a name could carry. It was seen that he embodied the essence of Tupaia. So though Tupaia died in Batavia, he still lives in New Zealand.
Robert King, you're suggesting that Tupaia was able to communicate with the local Maori by using the archaic form of Te Reo Maori. This was in the same way as Latin was used in Europe among priests and learned people. And people still know that language today, and how widely spread is it among the Polynesian peoples?
I can't speak for the wider Polynesian people, but for our own people, in particular the person I was talking about was Hiko Tarangi Hohepa. He passed away in 98, just when I completed my thesis. He spoke at length with us about the communication he was able to have and the very little difference still in the shift of the ritual language. And when I was growing up, I heard our people speak that language quite often, and it was almost like a foreign language to me, as opposed to Māori that we speak generically, the sort of that is now common. But the dialects of Te Aroa in particular, and around the Bay of Plenty, they in themselves are very different from the dialects of around Taranaki, from the South Island, or from up north. And then within those dialects, you also had this other language that was maintained by this learned school of what we consider philosophers, priests, and they had acolytes. They trained young people they picked out at a very young age. And I suggest that Tupaia, the young man travelling with him, was an acolyte.
And I thought perhaps what he gave to the Maoris in New Zealand was that ability to communicate with the colonisers, and that was extremely important in the developing relationship, and illustrates the contrast in that developing relationship between New Zealand and Australia. Do you have any comment on that?
In the first instance, you just sparked a thought, and that was when Cook returned on his second voyage, and the people called for Tupaia and then heard that he is gone. In a way, they were probably looking at what the reciprocity would also mean with his return, what new ideas he was going to bring back from this land that these white people came from. And as you pointed out, when Tupaia came to Australia, very quickly he became excess baggage to the to Cook and Banks. He was no longer had any knowledge that they could draw upon and leverage. The relationship, or the difference between New Zealand and Australia, comes from two very different cultures. One that's deep-seated in thousands of years of interacting with a fairly harsh environment. But notwithstanding that, those that lived around the ocean side and up the rivers where it was fertile at least had something in common, and that was the ability to interact with the ocean. But there was no discussion, no opportunity to understand each other, so we can only speculate again.
That's very interesting. I wonder whether one of the reasons Cook didn't spend a lot of time in Australia is because he didn't have a local blackfella.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.